Session number 12217, Reel 5.
Delaying Reel 5.
And my convoy landed at Heliopolis Aerodrome, but I was ordered in the air to fly the Blenheim to Hurghada, which is on the Red Sea, and a training airfield. And it was full of aeroplanes taking off and landing. And I had permission to land, and I was on the route. I must tell you, when I was flying over Accra, which was just north of Khartoum, I must retrace a bit. I was flying over Accra, there was one of the silencer stacks, exhaust stacks, was waving around and had come adrift on the port side. And this was very worrying. We flew on, there's nothing we could do, there's nowhere we could land. We flew on, and then I managed to contact Attenborough, and I said, have you any facilities for engine repairs? And they said no, but I said, well, we've got to land with you. We've got the exhaust pipes all falling off, you see. And I said, before it hits, we've got to land with you before it hits the tail, which would have been the end of us. I mean, we've been dead. And suddenly it fell off and it missed the tail. But I still landed at Accra. And they had no facilities at all, and all we had was a town in ring with no exhaust pipe. So I was giving a lift to two or three mechanics, and one was a warrant officer, an engineer warrant officer, and he said the mixture will be changed, and the engine will overheat. We have to take a lot of care of that engine on the way up, because we had another 500 miles to do. So we and the convoy all took off, and as I say, I dropped off the convoy at Cairo, 500 miles up. We still got this engine, and we kept it at low, you know, looking after it as best we could, kept the temperature down, cylinder head temperature down. Anyway, we got to Hurghada, and we're on the circuit, on the left-hand circuit, weaving between other light aircraft that had people under training in them, but we had the green light to land. And when it was about 15 degrees off the runway, the engine seized solid. That engine seized solid, prop stop, and I, from then onwards, I had the utmost difficulty in controlling it. I had about five people on board, and we were so low by this time. And there was a beach with a lot of the runway was there, and there was a beach and the Red Sea there. There was a lot of airmen, some bathing and swimming, and I couldn't get it back onto that runway without stalling it and turning it. I could feel there was no hardly any control, because it's the inside engine, and that's fatal. It's the inside engine you want running, the outside one would be okay, but anyway, circumstances as they were, I put it down on the beach with the wheels down, and it went up on its nose, and the nose dropped off, and we were all hurtled out on the beach, and all I'd got was a gash on the leg, and one or two of the people in the aircraft weren't strapped in, of course, because there were no places to be strapped in, they were just sitting on the floor. They were hurtled out on the beach, but nobody was seriously injured. They've got cut heads and bruises and so on. I was in hospital for a couple of days with stitches in my left knee and so on. That was the only other incident on the Takoradi ferry run, and I think that, combined with the fact that I'd had malaria about the month before, got me taken off it. And I was a bit disappointed because I liked the job.
So that must have been August or September 1941.
September or later October 1941. Anyway, I was then posted to Gordon Street as a fighter pilot instructor, operational training unit. And I was only there about a week, and they asked me if I'd like to go to Palestine to be operational training instructor on Hurricanes with the Greek Air Force, the Royal Hellenic Air Force, number 335 Squadron at Lydda, which is Tel Aviv Airport, which is the same airport as the present one, but it was called Lydda in those days. And I was with them, with the Greek Air Force, training and test flying, because there was another ferry unit operating from Cairo to India at that time, 41, 42. And we used to have aircraft coming in, because we had a maintenance unit at Lydda at that time. They'd come in and they had no test pilot when they were repairing the aircraft for engine trouble or something. They had no test pilots for Blenheims and Hurricanes and Kitty Hawks and Tomahawk. And I was a station test pilot, plus the friend of CO, who was Group Captain Chichester, brother of Sir Francis Chichester, the yachtsman. And he came from Tavistock here. The family seats down there. And Firpo Chichester, his name was. He was a big boxer in the Air Force, or had been, getting on in years, but he was our station commander.
How did you find the Greek pilots?
Well, the Greek pilots really were the aristocrats. They were either diplomats' sons or titled, Greek title people. And unfortunately, the pilots were okay. They were flying all right. But I don't think their medical fitness was as strict as ours. If you were an aristocrat, you could be a fighter pilot. But anyway, they're amazing people, because they'd all made their way from Greece around through Turkey and down Syria, down into Palestine. That's how they got to Cairo, all of them, when the Germans were, you know, running through Greece. That's the way they got to us.
What was wrong with their state of health?
What?
What was wrong with their state of health?
Well, one or two of them died under my RAF-type training. One of them went straight in from 20,000 feet for no reason at all, and he must have passed out. It was a warlord crime, it was a climb, as we used to term it. It's all laid down in the Air Force manual. But anyway, it was in those days. But apart from that, they were okay. And the COs, the wing commanders and the squadron leaders, they were all from high society. Or one of them, our wing commander, Barbaressus, which is Varvaressus, but it's Barbaressus, we call him. He was a big wine grower in Greece, you know, big wealthy man. Anyway, they were all right, and they trained, and they went out to the Western Desert, joined the fighting in the Western 335 Squadron. Then I had another squadron of Greeks called 336 Squadron. And then I was posted in about June, May 1942, when the training program finished, completed two squadrons, and they both went out to the desert. I didn't go with them, and because I was RAF, I was posted to, I was asked what I wanted to do. And a friend of mine at that time in the Gezira Sporting Club was Adrian Warburton, who was the most famous PRU pilot of the war. He did more operational flying hours than anybody else in the Air Force, I do believe, and went missing in April 1945, right at the end of the war, after flying on operations the whole war. He said, why don't you join me? It's a marvellous job, PRU. He said, you go up in the Balkans. He said, I've got one gun, and I go around the training air drones and shoot down odd training aeroplanes with one gun. but taking pictures all the time. And that's how I joined PRU. He persuaded me.
How did you like the photo reconnaissance work yourself?
Oh, it was all right. We used to fly. We had a milk run to Tobruk every day, and we had various other milk runs. That's the daily trips. But it began to get dangerous, and we lost about four people all over in about three or four, or a couple. You know, it was a very exclusive job. There were very few pilots, only six of us in the unit at the time. But we lost about four of them, and then I became about the fifth one.
You already described that earlier, but how did you come to know Adrian Warburton through the Gezira Sporting Club?
Well, he was operating in Malta under Air Marshal, Air Vice Marshal Lloyd, I think, and he was such a marvellous man. I mean, he'd got the DSO for the Taranto. He enabled the Taranto raid to take place, because he just flew around the ships with his camera taking pictures, and then the Navy went in with their torpedoes after seeing his pictures, and he got the DSO for that. And but he was amazing, man. He did thousands of hours on Blenheims. We had Blenheim. We had a DC, a Douglas airliner, nine-seater airline that we used to use, photographing there. We used to go to the Balkans and everywhere, all around southern Europe. It's amazing where we used to go to. We used to go to Piraeus every day. But the Germans got wise to us. They sent 610Gs to shoot us down, special, just to shoot us one airplane down. And they got us one after the other, actually, over a period of about 2 months. That's how I was able to join them, because they'd lost pilots and they wanted very experienced pilots for the job.
Now, there's just one final thing I'd like to ask you about the time when you were a POW in Stalagluft 3. There was the famous Great Escape which took place.
I was number 120. It was a very highly organised escape, that.
Did you escape yourself?
No, only 87 got out through the tunnel or something, 85 got out through the tunnel.
What are your memories of that great escape?
Well, the terrific organisation by one man, really, and that was Group Captain, Squadron Leader...
Bushell?
Roger Bushell. And the amazing thing about him is that people don't know, but we understood that he was a very special individual. He was CO, first of all, of one of the London squadrons, 601, I think, before the war, auxiliary squadron. Auxiliary. He was a London barrister. He was educated at Heidelberg University. He was a South African, and he was really the big boss of 3,000 of us. We had group captains, but they were unimportant. They even got him out. I understood he was out wandering around Germany and doing. And getting messages back to England for it was 6 months, and then he came and knocked on the door to be let back in again. And this man was absolutely out of this world. I mean, an unbelievable man. There were a few others, I believe, like Captain Stirling from Scotland and the desert, long rain desert. But he was one of their ilk. And in our camp, he was absolutely responsible for 500 of us who were on the escape organisation. 500 on the escape out of 3,000. I mean, some were tunnellers. I was a map maker, a boring job, actually. But so there were tunnellers, engineers, electricians. We had three tunnels being dug at the same time, you know. Three. And one, well... I've got amazing record of it.
How disappointed were you that you didn't go out?
I don't think it's a case of disappointment. I mean, it was so highly organised. We were sort of drawn out of the hat for number. I think the first 10 or 12 were definite. Numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And one was the engineer, Canadian engineer, who was a tunnel designer. I mean, it was 350 yards long in sand. I mean, it's unbelievable. But there was Tom, Dick and Harry. And, of course, Tom was found and Dick was found, but Harry never was found. And that was the longest. I mean, that was the impossible one. They weren't even looking for a thing that was as stupid as a tunnel that length. Anyway, it was electrically lit, which was unbelievable. We all became professionals in something in the skateboard. We had professional pickpockets that weren't pickpockets. They were pickpockets, any of the Germans' pockets. I mean, and I even had a general come in, Dunray, we used to have generals come in. These funny men used to come in and prance around and have us sort of on parade, and we used to arrive with no clothes on. You know, we didn't treat them with any respect whatsoever. And this was orders. Don't get any idea. We didn't do it on our own. We were told, right, the General so-and-so is coming tomorrow. It may be in the middle of winter in the snow, by the way. In Poland, there was 20 degrees below, that was no fun either. And we'd arrive, nothing on at all, you know, stand there, tension! And they pinched his dispatch case one day. And we had a stamp, which was the census stamp, geprüft, which is checked, you know, G-E-P-R-U-F, I think it is.
Geprüft.
Sargon, look three. And that was a stamp, rubber stamp made out of a potato, beautifully carved and so on. And every page of his war manual, when he found his dispatch case, and it was marked, geprüft, by Sargon three. His secret war manual, a general, he was probably shot. There's not much doubt about that. He would be court-martialed and shot. But they even, you know, the bribery that went on, and it was all organised by Roger Bushell and his committee to bribe the German, any German that came into the camp, because we used to have workmen coming into the camp. And it was absolutely ruthless. I mean, dozens and dozens of Germans were shot. And, I mean, that was our job. And many of we could get killed and bumped off, the better. So losing tools and equipment, or having their pickets pockets picked. No, it's an amazing experience. And the admiration by the Americans, the Australians and the New Zealanders for the British or the English contingent, or the British Isles contingent, if you like, the amount of work and the discipline and the organisation of that camp, the praise was at the end of the war by these people, by the Americans especially. Because we had 500 Americans there. We had Colonel Clark, who was General Clark's son, and anyway, a number of them. But it was an amazing crowd of people, and it was my education complete in that camp.
What do you remember about getting the news of the...
Well, we were told to be in the block number so-and-so, and it was organised, and There were always guards in the camp during the all night long with dogs, Alsatian dogs, which are terrible things. I hate Alsatian dogs. I see them walking along the street and I'd like to shoot everyone I see. They're the most vicious blight of thing, animals that trained to be lethal to human beings as they were in Germany. Honestly, I have nightmares about it now, seeing them tearing into friends of mine. Anyway, we were somehow, I don't know how we did it, honestly, all night long getting into, and oh, during the, before, after Appell, you know, the counting of us, which was done morning and night, we were smuggled into this one block. We were given a bunk, to let your bunk, you know, you stay there until you're called. And we were called one after the other, right up to number 87. I was number 120, but there were 250 going to be got out of that camp in one night. That was the organisation. There were 250 of us in that block. And it was, of course, just early in the morning, probably just coming up at dawn, when things had gone wrong during the night in the tunnel. Kirby Green, he was shot in the escape. He was a very tall man, and very broad, and he'd got a suitcase, and he got stuck in the tunnel, and a lot of the tunnel fell in, and they had to clear it, and delayed it. And anyway, eventually, suddenly, there was a hue and a cry, because a German guard had seen somebody walking, crawling into the woods. But by that time, about 85 or 83 or something had got out. So it didn't get to me. And the Germans rushed in our block, you know, sort of ordered us out and lined up to be shot, we thought. But we had a lecture from the German commandant, who knew that his days were numbered. He was shot, Oberst, he was killed for that escape. But so were 50 of our fellows, including Roger Bushell.
What do you remember about getting the news that they'd been shot?
Oh, it was a big announcement. The Gestapo had notified the Luftwaffe, who were in charge of us, the German Air Force, that notified the chief, I suppose General Goering or something, who eventually notified our commandant, German commandant, who notified our group captain.
Did the Germans seem shamefaced about the executions?
Well, it was coming really as it did, and the people that were shot, they had no excuse. I mean, they were shot in the back of the head, in the cells throughout Poland and anywhere where they were. And there was no rhyme or reason for that. They sent back a lot. And there was no sort of, they got the ringleaders, got them all. Got all the best people. Shot them. But the rest, I mean, there was no rhyme or reason. They just sent some back and some they shot. One from my room, a South African. He was a tunneler. He was shot. A nice bloke, nothing wrong with him at all, but he was one of those shot.